This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 31st of December, 1956. The title of this lecture is Sub-Zero Scale, Relation to Scale of Awareness. This lecture is 61 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Well, here we are coming down to the last couple hours of this Congress. And I don't want you to go away without information. This Congress, by the way, is a rather interesting Congress in that it's composed almost entirely of professional auditors, professional and special members. Do you realize that? And the others who are here, we welcome them very much. We welcome them very much. I have tried to keep the data which I've been giving you fairly comprehensible on a general level, but it so happens that there are so many professionals in the audience that I have from time to time, you might say, skidded a bit and gone upstairs into high-flown nomenclature, and so forth. There are about 492 Scientology terms. We're right at this moment working on a dictionary, a Dianetics and Scientology dictionary, giving the basic definition of each one of these terms. Most of these terms, by the way, are English words which are simply defined, probably for the first time, accurately. Now, we have something new now. We have something brand new. We have numbers of scales in Dianetics and Scientology. Science of Survival, for instance, a book is devoted entirely to a basic tone scale. And all it really takes up is simply the emotional band of the tone scale, the prediction of behavior along that band. Well, we've come a long way since Science of Survival, but Science of Survival is very, very basic information. And we have come forward with more knowingness on the subject of these scales with the sub-zero scale. Now, this first appeared in Scientology 880 several years ago. And I wrote it off very glibly, figured it out, put it down, and that was that. You know, it's finished work. Years afterwards, I cognite. Boom. Small blue flash. And I says, no, it cannot be. It cannot possibly be that the sub-zero tone scale was not just a mathematical abstraction, that it is found in real life. Originally, it was deducted on this basis. An individual cannot remember many things. Therefore, he must be in another state of mind, the knowingness. And we found that a thetan, the basic unit of life, actually was in another frame of mind than the body. The body was in certain frames of mind, and these were the upper scale, and the thetan could get down to lower frames of mind than the body could. These were frames of mind below death. Now, that's a great oddity, to have a frame of mind below death, but it had to be explored. It was explored. There it was. Now, the sub-zero tone scale, emerged a relatively short time ago as being the most important single item we had anything to do with. It is the scale below apathy. Now, we'd drawn this scale up beautifully. I mean, there was the upper scale. There were the emotional scales that came down from way up, high states of serenity and knowingness, you see, and that came down to enthusiasm way down low and then went lower into conservatism and boredom and antagonism and down into fear, anger, fear, and went down below that into grief. And below grief, why, it went into apathy. And when a person got down that low, he was simply approaching death. Of what? Not of himself, because he can't die. I know religion has been telling us for years that the spirit does not die. It goes to heaven and gets tortured or something. Well, whatever happens, we don't care in somebody's textbook, because that would be just a bunch more potchless, you see. You actually could fix up a heaven, you could fix up a hell, you could have all sorts of behavior, and actually there is a thing in parascientology called the between lives area, and I guess this is what they were talking about. But we are not trying to force good behavior on everyone by telling them that if they misbehave, there they go. That's an enforced behavior mechanism. There probably is a hell. Probably many hells. Early Christian religion actually adds up seven hells. There isn't just one hell, there's seven. There's a hell of ice and all sorts of things. We really, with an E-meter, plotted this out on the track and found out there were various stages of existence. And they were all categorized and called hell. There are all sorts of hells. All sorts of hells. I suppose to some people, unfortunate ones, getting married would be hell. To other people, getting born in the wrong family, that would be hell. There are lots of man-made existing hells right here on earth. The only thing, however, that can harm a person is to deny himself. When he denies himself, why, he is in an interesting state of being from there on out. That is to say, he can do some things which change his frame of mind about his own beingness. That is to say, he denies himself. He says he doesn't exist, he negates himself, he does other things. And I suppose these things could lead up to a sort of a hell. But the sub-zero tone scale would be, in essence, a sort of hell. Man dies. What happens to him? Well, what happens to him? He loses a body. That's what happens to him. And what happens to him when he loses a body? Very simple. His havingness is reduced. And what happens when his havingness is reduced? He goes onto the sub-zero scale, which is below apathy. And below apathy, you have no memory. That's all. There went your past lives. If your havingness on bodies was bad, and you considered it important to lose one, after they covered you with flowers and shoved you into the crypt, you thought you were being shoved into the crypt. And you plugged off in a state of, we thought at first, couldn't care less. Now, we're talking very factually now. There isn't an auditor, I don't think, who has not in some fashion encountered this phenomenon of past lives. You know this Bridie Murphy thing? Yeah. Well, we stopped this in England. We stopped it cold. One of the papers, the Express, was just going all out on Bridie Murphy, Bridie Murphy, Bridie Murphy. And we went around and told them, now listen, Bridie Murphy isn't very unusual. What you're going to run into is what every Dianetist and Scientologist runs into. Not how to get people into past lives, but how to get them out of them. This was very interesting to the paper. And within 2 or 3 days, they had received so many letters from people in the public at large concerning their own past lives that they realized that printing any more on the subject was simply a waste of time. And they ceased and desisted and actually said, if I remember rightly, that Scientologists had this all taped, and that was that. We didn't care whether people worried about this. The auditor there, he told the editor he was just heading for a landslide in the wrong direction, and he had found this was the case. Now, when an individual dies, what happens to him exactly? Well, nothing happens to him except a change of state of mind. That's what happens to him. Now, he loses havingness and goes on the sub-zero scale, the below apathy scale. Now, you've seen people who have experienced sudden losses. Some fellow who has all of a sudden had his car stolen, or his wife has just run away with somebody, or something like that. He's had a sudden loss. He's in a state of aniten. He's rather unconscious about the whole thing. He goes into a duh. Now that duh might last for a minute, an hour, days, or the rest of his life. Now the loss of some dear one leaves a person. Loss of an ally, we say, leaves a person dropped in tone. Well, exactly what is this manifestation of being dropped in tone? It is not being aware of. Not being aware of. There is nothing there now to confront. And it is an inability and an impossibility of further confronting that thing, which brings about a reverse mechanism of non-awareness. Now, we see this dramatized this way. Here's this podium. We're aware of it because it is there. Now, we take it away, and it is not there. And those of us who were fortunate enough to be above zero on the tone scale can remember that it was here. So an awareness continues in the absence of the mass. Actually, it is not necessary for a person in good condition to have the mass in order to be aware of. But after a while, they become so dependent on the mass in order to make them aware of something that when you remove the mass, they are no longer aware of it in any way. Now, can you conceive of this podium being removed and suddenly not knowing, remembering, or being aware of the fact that there was ever a podium here? It's pretty hard to imagine, but can you conceive that? Well, that's pretty far down. It's pretty far down, but that is the case with a body. An individual depends so much on the body being there that he doesn't remember it the moment it's removed. And that's the sub-zero scale. And there is the memory of your last life. That's all there is to it, I'm afraid. One becomes so dependent on a body telling him it's there that when it isn't there, he doesn't know it has ever been there. Now, you can conceive that state of being, just intellectually conceive it, I'm sure. Now, an individual goes through life with the havingness of a body, with its perception assists, and all a body does is magnify perception. All ears do, or magnify sound. All the nose does is magnify smell. It's a magnification unit. It doesn't create the perception. It is like listening to everything with an ear trumpet. And one becomes so dependent of listening to everything with an ear trumpet, an ear, that when he hasn't got an ear, he can't hear. Can you understand how that would be? Now, if you were to put on somebody a hearing aid turned way up in volume and insist that he wear it, 3 or 4 years, at the end of that time, if you were to take the hearing aid away from him, he'd be deaf. No, he could readjust. And he could get back to a point where he could hear without the hearing aid. And so do people do this when they get another body. They, however, are only replacing one hearing aid with another hearing aid, aren't they? But if they didn't have a body long enough, they would begin to hear again. That's fact. But they're never without one any length of time. They say, I've got to have one. And they go flip from the mortuary to the maternity ward by whatever route, we care not. And there they are. That happens to be the truth of the matter. Now, it's an interesting thing that we consider falsely children and child behavior to be basic Thetan behavior. We say, behave very simply, like a little child. No, an auditor learns a great deal when he starts to process children. It is not a native Thetan response. He exteriorizes somebody and then finds out how they respond. They don't respond like children. They're much brighter. They're much smarter, much more alert, much more aware, much better able to control things. Children, during the early years of their lives, are in the state of shock of the last death. They have to be handled carefully because they're still experiencing loss. Look at the swap. They got this great big podium. They go along living with this great big podium, see? And then they get back this little tiny object. And it doesn't replace their havingness. Not until their havingness comes up to a proper poundage do they feel then that they can behave well and normally. And that is child behavior. Juvenile delinquency is only the frustration of having a body almost big enough in a society which won't permit you to use it. That's all juvenile delinquency is. Juvenile delinquency is the direct result of child labor laws. Child can't have any part of the society. Well, somebody imposed those laws for some reason. Usually, it was the idea that we had too much labor anyhow and we were trying to cut down the labor market. But children are scattered and nervous when they are not permitted to have a part of the society. What's this? This is more denial of havingness. Look, you wouldn't just have this podium. You'd have the podium and the stage and the room, see? And when you give a child a body and then won't let him have his environment too, he, of course, is in a reduced state of havingness and continues in an agitated frame of mind. Rome behaved quite differently, by the way. A child at the age of about 12 was usually made some sort of an official or an officer in the better families. By the time he was 14, he was usually commissioned to something or other. He did something. In other words, he had a job. It didn't matter whether he was a foreman or whatever else he was. He was made to be something. Time he was 14, and we oddly enough in all of the wax tablets find no accounts of juvenile delinquency. We don't even find much said about that younger generation. Now, we're all on the subject of havingness right now. In other words, if you could give a child not only the havingness that he has, but the environment too, and show him that he was a part of this environment and he was back where he had been to some degree, he'd measure up and come along. But if we keep denying him havingness continually, he'll eventually get into a below apathy state as a child. He will become a below apathy man who cannot remember, who has no responsibility. You see this? Now, we're not talking about juvenile delinquency. We're simply talking about human beings and thetans. They evidently go on this cycle, and when they lose that body on which they're totally dependent, they now know they aren't. They fall down on the below apathy scale. No responsibility, no memory, no awareness. Why? Because they have nothing to confront with. I get that very carefully. That's why I say the ear magnifies sound. A voice is a speaker system which magnifies the noise you can make. Actually, for your voice to resonate at all, it is necessary for you, a thetan, to make noise. You understand? You're making noise that's so faint, however, that it requires some sort of a magnification system to be heard. Just like in a large hall, I use a PA system, so do you in a friendly conversation use a voice. Not because you can't talk, but because you can't talk loud enough to be heard without a voice. What do we mean by voice? We mean vocal cords. Larynxes are rather interesting. Now, a PA system can so educate a person that he is no longer able to fill much of a hall with his voice. The Greek chorus, back before Rome even got going, used to wear masks. I ran into one of them one time when I was being trained down in Hollywood. I ran into a pair of masks, comedy and tragedy. It was very fascinating because the Greek mask of the Greek theater was not something to alter or change the identity. It was the only way they could think of to mask a megaphone. You know how resonant a violin is? Well, so were these old Greek masks resonant. They had a vocal magnification unit, more or less made on the same magnification principles as a violin. Resonant wood. Thin resonant woods. And these fitted across the actor's face and mouth. And as he spoke back of the mask, his voice became loud enough to be heard all through one of their very interesting stadiums. In other words, it was a magnification unit. Now, what happened to a Greek actor who wasn't permitted to use a mask? Well, very often you will try to train somebody in acting and they can't talk loud enough to be heard in a small theater. Well, they recall vividly that they should be wearing a mask. Now, the first hour of the second day of this Congress, somebody had neglected in the engine room to throw on our PA system. And I talked to you for that hour without a PA system in a hall here, which is rather large. I don't think you had too much difficulty hearing me. But I had difficulty kicking my voice to the back end of the hall and forward again, merely because I had been using a PA system in all other hours of lecture. You get the difference. I depended upon that havingness to serve my voice and make my voice audible to you. And then the engineer of the hotel did not turn on the PA system, and we were unable to get to it until the break. And I noticed then that I was talking under a strain. It was a strain to talk that loudly. Of course, I bring something to your attention. It's not usual to be able to talk in a hall this loud. But I've talked previously in many halls with worse acoustics than this one. And at the end of hours and hours, I've never felt any strain at all, merely because I didn't need, hadn't thought of, and didn't like to use a PA system because they keep me pinned down in front of a microphone, which keeps me away from my audience, and I don't like them very much. It poses a barrier. It puts a shiny thing between me and the audience. I don't like that. All right. Now, there's your dependency. You, as a thetan, can talk. If you can't, there would be nothing to magnify. Your body doesn't talk. Your body's a meaty sort of PA system. If you try to work with a stammerer, for heaven's sakes, don't try to work with the body's voice. Hasn't anything to do with it. You're working with a thetan who won't talk. Because he can't talk. Because he can't communicate. How do you work a stammerer? You have him go around and feel the walls and touch things. Confront things and become aware of things, and that cures stammering. The only reason you'd have any difficulty at all with a stammer is because stammerers are usually in pretty foul condition. As cases, you just have to run them just as long as you would have to run them from that level of case. It has nothing to do with stammering. There isn't anything to do with stammering at all. You follow me? It's merely a symptom of communication. You wouldn't run his voice. You would exercise a thetan until he had some confidence in being able to communicate. And so it is in all branches of bodiness. All conditions of having a body and not having a body, whatever they are, however many times and how many languages they're categorized in, no matter how many times they are categorized, no matter how many new words you apply to it all, comes down to this. You're dealing with a bit of livingness which is good or bad relatively on the subject of confrontingness and therefore awareness. A person could have a body and say, you know, there's nothing to confront. There's nothing here. You process many a preacher and he'll tell you he hasn't got a head. You're sitting right there looking at a head. But if he looks it over, he says it's hollow. Hollow. He hasn't got a chest. There's just a big void. There's a hole. There's no chest. What is this? It's just he cannot confront a head. He cannot confront a chest. Therefore, he can't be aware of them. And when you call his attention to it, mind you, you have to call his attention to it. He becomes aware of the fact that he's not been aware of them. And the only reason processing works is because he can be aware of you who are aware, and thus through that route can confront other things and become aware of them. You see that? As an auditor, you're an awareness pilot. You're a guide to things to confront. All right, we had a lot of fun with Dianetics. Dianetics is a terrific subject. No doubt about it. Everybody said so. It must be true. But Dianetics is a subject appertaining to the mind. And there are two other factors. There's the thetan and there's the physical universe. And they are not much included in Dianetics. But being aware of the mind all by itself was quite an adventure. Here was something that nobody had been aware of the fact they were confronting at all. And you came along and you said to the fellow, go back to birth. He says, birth? You said, yeah, go back to birth. All right, go back to birth. Well, he says, what do you know? And he found out he had a picture of it.
Well, how was it that he was unaware that he had a picture of birth? How'd he get this stupid? That he didn't know he had a picture of birth. And that mental experts, the length and breadth of the world, experts spelled with a sneer, mental experts would say, oh, fie, 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 the idea of going back to birth. Oh, we ever heard of such nonsense? And then we got up to prenatals. We talked about prenatals. Boy, the mental experts. Boy, mental experts weren't aware of prenatal engrams, of the ramifications of mental image pictures. They weren't aware of the mental image pictures of past lives. Boy, they weren't aware. It must have been that they were either unwilling to or couldn't confront them. And when you told them about them, and they still wouldn't look, you were dealing with below apathy. On what subject? On the subject of the human mind. It happens that we are not below apathy on the subject of the human mind today. And that's the first time that man has been above apathy on the subject. So, we're upscale adventurers as far as that's concerned. But don't be upset when somebody tells you there ain't no such animal as a giraffe while he's standing in front of the giraffe's cage. He just can't confront a giraffe. That's all. He can't confront a giraffe well enough to see one. All right, he can't confront a mental image picture enough to see one. He can't confront a body enough to have one. To see one, to be one. Do you see that? His awareness on the subject is not up to an observation. His ability to confront is not up to awareness. So what do we get from zero on down? We get from zero down unawareness. That is all. That's what we get. We get unawareness from zero down. Now, the funny part of it is, here's something very amusing. It is not true that all thetans are below zero in awareness. One time I ran into an Apache Indian. Started talking to him about engrams and past lives, that sort of thing. He told me all about it. He didn't know how to articulate it. Never occurred to him nobody else was aware of this. He'd been out with Geronimo against the U.S. Army. He remembered four lives like that, in all details. In spite of the fact that he'd never completely gotten over a superior feeling toward the white man, having whooped everybody under Geronimo. Ran into a little girl one day. Little girl was chattering along down to Lincoln Memorial. She was chattering along. The mother was standing there saying, yes, dear, be quiet, dear. Yes, dear, be quiet. Yes, be quiet. And so forth. Mother wasn't even listening. And I listened in on this. She was saying, oh, mummy, he wasn't that big. She was talking all about Abraham Lincoln, the last time she saw him when he made the Gettysburg Address. She wasn't talking in good English because she was quite young, but she hadn't yet got her face pushed in on the subject of she mustn't remember a past life. Now you can sort of enforce that as an agreement in the fashion and compound this non-awareness. But here was somebody who had been present when Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address and who heard him in person from the front row. Lisping. Be quiet, dear. Be quiet, dear. I'm looking this over. Kid could have told Mama all about this, but the kid didn't even know Mama didn't know. Get the idea? So there was an interesting zone of unawareness. But here was somebody, probably in between lives area, that probably didn't go any further south than maybe 1-1 or something like that. Lost a body and said, I'll get even with him. I won't attack him right now. I'll come back later. You see, that scenario, that's between lives. In other words, a body died and was buried, and here for the next succeeding period of a few days or a few hours or a few weeks, somebody said, well, they're not going to put me out of the game that easily, in total awareness, and picked up another body and then just didn't think about it for a while, but was aware of having been and done. It's not necessarily true that people drop out the bottom. But the largest majority of people at this time do drop out the bottom in this culture. They just go down below zero, and that's that. Because we have it all going so strongly now that one only lives once. Rather despairingly and disastrously, it is true, but he still lives once, kind of. That's the way the society sort of looks, you know. And when you die, you're gone forever. You actually hear people saying this. When a person says that, I invite you to do something else. Study his confrontingness. Study his general awareness. You find this way down here someplace. Now, every once in a while, somebody picks up another body and stays in a below zero state and doesn't do anything with the body. It's too precious. Catatonic schizophrenia. Fancy name. It only means they lie still. Some other people can't control a body. They can't have one. That's all that means. You can't control something, you can't have it. Which means that you can't confront it. Which means you're in it. Now, the whole subject of interiorization is an unwillingness to be outside looking in. When a person has a body but can't confront one, he can't get out of one. Because if he got out of one, he'd confront it. And here we have the first positive proof of the definition of space as given in Scientology 8008. Space is a viewpoint of dimension. That is what space is. Space is that across which one looks. Space is not a thing. Space, existence of, therefore, depends on the phenomenon of willingness to confront. Is there any confirmatory data for this? Oh, yes, there certainly is. A person who's unwilling to confront doesn't have any space. He doesn't have any space in the bank. He doesn't have any space in his life. He can't tolerate space. He can't have anything to do with it. Because when one confronts things, he makes space. If he's unwilling to confront them, he becomes them. And you get the phenomenon of havingness. Very amusing if you had a number of very ugly, horrible statues parked around in the society that were just very gruesome to confront. You'd find little kids taking on the aspects of the statues. Got that? And then they would become unaware of having taken on the aspect of the statue, and one fine day would do something else quite interesting. They would get audited. And they'd start to become aware of one of these manifestations, dimly aware of it, and they would get into a beingness of it, which they'd already had at one time or another. And you as an auditor, if you led them through to confront whatever it was, would find out that it all of a sudden separate from them. In other words, they could look at it. So space could be defined as a willingness to confront. Space is the viewpoint of dimension. If you are unwilling to look at something, There's not going to be any space between you and it. Now, I'll give you an idea of this. If you get a person to solve things because he has to and can't confront the problem, see, an absolute necessity to solve it because he can't confront it, you'll find out that the problems he solves snap in on him. This is a manifestation any preacher will tell you about. You say you've got a problem with your wife. Fine. Give me a solution to that problem. Good. Give me another solution to that problem. Good. Give me another solution to that problem. What's happening? When you first asked him about a problem with his wife, he had an idea of something out there in some imagery space in front of him. He had a thing out there. And every time you asked him to solve it, it got closer to him. Because you had picked a thing he was unwilling to confront and knew he had to solve. You get the idea? In other words, you make him more and more anxious about solving it, convincing him that he must solve it. You're telling him at the same time that he mustn't confront it. And the problem moves right on in and finally sits on his nose. And if it goes a little bit further, it'll get behind his head, this thing. Now, we say, give us a problem of comparable magnitude. What have we done? We've asked him to look at the problem, haven't we? A problem of comparable magnitude. He's looked at it by substitute. He substituted a new problem for the old problem, and you merely asked him to get the new problem. He was willing to view this new problem one way or the other. You say, give me a problem of comparable magnitude to your difficulties with your wife. And he says, yes, a prairie fire. He'll have a picture of a prairie fire out here someplace. Another problem, comparable magnitude. Yes, being in a lion's cage. You get a picture of a lion's cage out here. This other thing, the mental image pictures, bundle of, that he was unwilling to confront and went scrunch with, every time he gets a problem of comparable magnitude, this moves out further in front of him. Out it goes. And finally, it's way out there. And he finally tells you, I don't know why I'm worried about that. Some preclears are not aware of the fact that they've changed, which is very baffling to an auditor. Upsetting. You change him all over the place. You put his heels where his head is. You change his appearance, his attitudes, his tastes. He isn't aware of anything having happened. We assume then that you must have changed some body characteristics and you did not invite the preclear to participate in confronting anything. He came there to have it done for him. You did it for him. You did all the confronting. You did change him. The body responded to you. And if you went along that way just far enough, you would tell that body to walk and it would walk and he wouldn't be able to do a thing with it. You got how that would be? In other words, you have to invite the preclear's participation in this confrontingness, and therefore you have to consult his powers of choice and his cooperation and get him to confront things for him to become aware of anything. And that's the phenomenon of the preclear who tells you nothing happened. He's been all over the floor, the ceilings, the walls. He's lost all sorts of manifestations and so on. You didn't ask him to confront anything. These things just happened. See, that isn't your fault, by the way. It has nothing to do with it. His awareness was in terrible condition. The case had to be started in a much lower plane than you started it. Had to be started in a lower plane. Is there anything around here you wouldn't mind looking at? 2-hour comm lag ensues. First, he's merely trying to find something around to look at. And you know there's a room there. You know there's a room there. There obviously is a room there. You can see it. Can he? But when he leaves, he goes to the door. Or is that a training mechanism of some sort that he is no longer aware of either? Can he see the rug on the floor and the walls? You run some HC on these people, very gentle, and you will find out that he was not really aware of anything. Suddenly somebody will all of a sudden, this is a very common manifestation, doesn't mean a person is bad off at all. He looks here and he says, you'd have him touch it. Touch it. All of a sudden he says, podium. We have them touch the wall, and somebody says, wow, a wall. You get that? He all of a sudden found out that you were having him confront something. Up to that time, there wasn't anything there to be confronted. So, of course, he wasn't aware of it. If you established you, the auditor, the Scientologist, and the auditing room, and the preclear's presence in the auditing session, 100%, you would have cleared him. That's how important those rudiments are. Now, if you just ask him to go on confronting thought, figure, all he's doing is trying to figure out how he can avoid confronting something else. The only awareness he has left is the fact that he can figure out some way not to be aware. And that is the case that doesn't progress. You ask him to be aware of some thought. Well, a Thetan can be aware of all kinds of thoughts. He can go on being aware of thoughts forever without ever becoming aware of a wall. He can go on figure without ever confronting actually two thoughts opposed. He can think of one thought at a time, but he can't think of two thoughts, so therefore he can't grasp a problem. A problem is two thoughts at least opposed. You see how this is? Now there is awareness, and there is processing. And this below zero scale has actually now developed into a very full scale of havingness. And that scale of havingness is as follows. At the very, very bottom, everything is created. Everything has been created. And something else is looking at it. Next above that is must be contributed to. Must be contributed to without ever being there to be contributed to. Or becoming aware of what was contributed. Next is must be confronted without being aware of what is going to do the confronting. Must be confronted. He's got to come over and see me. I won't go to him. By the way, don't try to add this scale up. This scale is composed of things of which we can be aware, or it wouldn't be a scale. An individual can actually do all of these things without being at any of these positions. And a fellow who is in good shape should be able to consider any of these things. Now the next one up above that is had. A person is had. He is eaten. He doesn't have. He himself is had. And next above that is waste. The scale is a little bit disorderly in its middle ranges, merely because the middle ranges are disorderly. Next above that is waste. If an individual has anything, he wastes it. In other words, the way to keep from confronting things is to waste them quick. I had a maid once that couldn't cook. Shouldn't be surprised that she threw all the food away. She'd take a 2-inch steak out of the icebox and throw it in the garbage can. Couldn't confront food. She still was enough aware of food to know how to keep from confronting food. You threw it away without noticing what it was. You have a roast for dinner, 3/4 of it's left, the next morning it's missing. What happened to it? Don't know. Didn't even remember she'd thrown it away. All right. Next up the line is substitute. One substitutes for the thing One never confronts the thing, he confronts the substitute to the thing, which tells you why problems of comparable magnitude solve problems. You're getting substitute problems. You get the individual to think up and confront substitute problems. First thing you know, he's all set. He can confront the problem because you're moving him upscale with auditing. Next above this is waste. Once more. You see, the lower waste is the waste of the substitute. And this upper waste is a waste of the thing itself. How do you keep from confronting women? You waste them. How do you waste them? Well, you never look at them. You join a monastery. All kinds of ways that you can keep from confronting women. You waste them. You do something with them. Now, you come upscale, and you run into have and havingness as we know it. And because such a tremendous number of people, body plus Thetan, are at this position on this particular scale, we find it is a very workable process. We find that people can't progress very far on the scale unless they run into this and have this one settled, because they're either just below it or just around it. So we can call this a havingness scale. But why? It would only be because people are pretty averagely somewhere in that vicinity at this time and place. Just because they happen to be there now. That's why havingness is important right now. All right, and we go up above have, and we get to confront. Only now do we get to confront. Now, where do we go from confront? We go to contribute to. A person can contribute to is a higher manifestation than to have. Perfectly true that it is better to give than to receive. It's higher on the scale. You inhibit people from contributing, you of course put them down into confronting, obsessive. When you forbid their obsessive confronting, you put them down into having. When you forbid their having, you put them down into wasting. When you put them down out from wasting, you put them into substitute. When you put them down from substituting things to waste, they'll waste the substitute. When you put them down from that, they've been had. Next, they must be confronted. They throw tantrums, so they'll come in. You come in and see what's happening. They must be contributed to. And they finally wind up with a complete, utter realization that they have been created. Totally. Now, up above this, up above contribute to, on the upper scale, we have one more stage. Create. The scale is topped with create and is bottomed with created. Now, down below that is just nothing in an inverse way. It is a nothingness that if something was there, it would be a nothingness. Even if there were something there, it would be nothing. You see how far down that is? People make nothing out of everything. You get the inhabitants of a village in India, preyed upon by a tiger, will sometimes refuse to take the slightest precautions. The tiger isn't. Well, there's these footprints, and there's the mangled body he dragged away last night. Yeah, it isn't any tiger, it's a ghost. Something, see? Even if it's there, it isn't. There's an atom bomb and it blows up cities, and there's a bunch of nuts that have it under control, ? Well, what about this? It isn't. On every side we hear this, it isn't. You know, it doesn't do anything, and if you spray radiation all over Earth, it doesn't do anything, and it doesn't amount to anything, and it wouldn't hurt anybody, and it doesn't concern me anyhow. And you know, it isn't. With such people, you could take right up in front of such a person, you could show him
Well, let's say a rat. You could hit him with a few wrenching. The rat's teeth would fall out. He'd shed all his hair and curl up and die. This person would tell you that's no evidence. Because that's the motto. There is no evidence at that level. No evidence can be exerted. Evidence cannot be observed because nothing can be confronted. So how can they even confront evidence? So why try to convince them of anything? Conviction is way upstairs. Conviction about anything involves participation in confronting it. To convince somebody, he must be a participant in confronting it. That's plain, isn't it? And so no evidence would tell these people that there was any danger in fishing. One day they wake up, they haven't got a body. They're below apathy, they wouldn't even know it. Kind of a gruesome look, isn't it? You say, well, why don't we just shovel those people in a dark hole someplace? Well, we say that's not a human thing to do. All right, so it's not a solution. There is a solution. Scientology. Now, as we look this over, this having the scale, we find out then that control would probably interpose, I don't know this for sure, between confront and contribute. Or possibly above contribute. But possibly control also intermingles all the way up and down the scale. And I'm not in a position at this moment to tell you exactly what that behavior is. But I will tell you that it's an important behavior. So, we find that an individual who cannot have a body, cannot control one, cannot be aware of one, and so he fades on out. This is the manifestation of insanity that I was talking to you about yesterday. An individual goes down the line and whatever he is just completely disappears as far as he's concerned. Now, it's a nothingness, isn't it? It's a total unawareness, which brings about with it a continued possession. So a total unawareness, which brings about with it a continued possession, brings about what we would consider psychotic behavior. In other words, somebody is not aware of the fact that a GMC Caterpillar tractor will plow a field, and yet there sits a GMC or a Caterpillar tractor sitting out there in the field, and the Chinese are all standing around and working with shovels. Well, we say, well, they just don't dare put each other out of work. I don't know that they don't. Maybe they're just not aware what tractors do, even when they see a tractor performing. When they see a tractor performing, they might not know what it's doing. They might not be aware of it, you see. Now, there's the having the scale, or the awareness scale, but it is totally a processing scale. And this is where you go in using processes from one thing to the next. Each one of these can be run objectively. Each one of them can be run subjectively. Havingness, confrontingness, contributing to things. These are all part and parcel of life. Now, the funny part of it is that people who are pretty aware of things do all of these things. And that makes a game. But when they do them and don't know that they're doing them, they're in trouble. And we've known that right along. That aberration was only upsetting when he didn't know he was doing it. And that all aberration includes in it a great many usual manifestations. Every insanity there is includes in it some travesty of normal conduct. All you do is exaggerate normal conduct with this proviso, that the person doesn't know he's doing it. And then you have behavior of an aberrated nature. So aberrated behavior is not necessarily insane. Aberrated behavior would be behavior which is being done without knowing it's happening. And that would be an aberrated behavior. All right, now there is the scale, and there's where awareness goes, where confrontingness goes. And I hope, when I talk to you a little bit more about this, that here too will go your pre-clears. Thank you.